In other news.
You know, the towers did not burn up. They turned into powder in midair.
That's scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
You walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
Welcome to Another News. I'm Jeff Brady. Headlines describing clashes between asylum-seeking migrants and the local population in the UK, for example, started gaining momentum late last year. Sexual crimes against minors, assaults, robberies, negative economic impacts, and welfare tax burdens are some of the reasons cited to prompt local outrage and protest marches. A controversial asylum hotel in Epping, Essex, UK, was recently shut down by local council responding to community protests. For the last 5 years, mass migrations of people have flooded into the countries of the European Union and the United States and Canada. Why? On the surface, the corporate news reports essentially they're people seeking asylum and are escaping harsh living conditions. However, the larger question as to why mass numbers of people migrate across borders is rarely explored. We hear a presentation from the Vienna Migration Conference. Author Kelly Greenhill, who wrote the 2010 book titled Weapons of Mass Migration, Forced Displacement, Coercion, and Foreign Policy, is in conversation with an International Center for Migration Policy Development representative. This presentation is from 2022. Greenhill is professor of political science and international relations at Tufts University. In this presentation, it's explained how certain nations will use migration diplomacy as leverage to achieve diplomatic, political, or economic goals. Essentially, human beings are used as bargaining chips. France, for example, is reported to be not doing enough to stop the flow of people invading the UK, and this inaction is seen as a form of migration diplomacy. Countries such as Libya, Morocco, and Turkey also use the threat of uncontrolled migration to exert diplomatic leverage on European countries. We also learn how Alexander Lukashenko used migration diplomacy as retaliation against EU sanctions. The sanctions were levied for his disputed re-election in 2020 and human rights abuse. Well, what about the United States and Canada? During most of the Biden administration and prior, corporate media news reported on caravan after caravan crossing the U.S. border from Mexico and more people flowing in from Canada. By the end of 2024, upward of 30 million people were brought into the United States from countries worldwide. How is it possible millions of asylum seekers quietly set out in travel and surprised the population of the targeted countries? Within the prevailing social fabric in the United States at the time, if you questioned the pouring in of unvetted people from countries worldwide, the conversation was often shut down. If the corporate media reported on the history of migration diplomacy and this tactic became common knowledge, a very different conversation would take place. As many know, bringing millions of people into a country and bypassing conventional immigration processing, it will create a devastating effect within a sovereign nation, and yet also create a myriad of opportunities for employees, the attacking country, politicians, and agencies governing social welfare systems. We go now to hear this presentation by Kelly Greenhill, professor of political science and international relations at Tufts University.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's a great pleasure to be able to do every year a geopolitical panel at the VMC, which is a tradition we started a few years ago, because we realized that, as a colleague of ours at ICMPD always says, you can't solve migration issues often with migration policy. You need other policies to solve migration issues. And I wanted to begin today by saying that before this incredibly traumatic year we had, where everyone has been so focused on the huge migratory challenge and, of course, the war in Ukraine and the huge outflow of refugees from Ukraine, that last year, the biggest event in EU asylum and migration policy for many years was actually the weaponization of irregular migration flows by the current Belarus regime. So I just wanted to take a quick moment, actually, to remind you about what actually happened. From early to mid to late last year, Belarus's leader, Alexander Lukashenko, tried to use 20,000 or around 20,000 asylum seekers to rush the EU's eastern frontier, targeting first Lithuania and then Poland from August onwards. Lukashenko lured Iraqis, various African nationals, and Syrians with single-entry visas to Minsk via Turkey, the Middle East, and Central Asia. Now, in that flow, it was a mixed flow. Small numbers of Afghans, Iranians, Indians, and even Cubans were among that cohort. Having paid up to 12,000 euros each for the passage to Germany, as we heard this morning from the Lithuanian deputy minister, they were told, we'd basically get you straight into Germany. The travellers were then pushed towards the frontier by the Belarusian regime in now scenes that I think we will remember, even despite Ukraine, the unbelievable scenes on television in order to force a confrontation with border guards and to tip the EU once again into panic and division over the issue of migration, because Lukashenko had obviously seen the events of 2015 and 2016 and how divisive and destructive that was to European politics. Now, unlike that time, the EU's response was actually quite robust. It also developed a brand new toolbox almost overnight for stemming the flows in cooperation with third countries. Vice President Margarita Skinas, who spoke to us last night from a new whistle-stop tour, then did a whistle-stop tour, if you remember, to Dubai, to Jordan, to Ankara, to Beirut, and to a number of other places where he was able to negotiate and incentivize cooperation with partners. One of the most important partners was Turkish Airlines, because they were able to convince private operators that a small trickle of flights to Minsk was not worth a 2 billion stake in the European aviation market. So the Europeans, for once, actually, although many I know in the room may criticize later that the response was too slow, they actually managed to bring an end to the crisis more quickly than was expected. They managed to use tools that they hadn't used before, and Alexander Lukashenko might have accidentally reinvented European migration diplomacy through his actions. Now, what exactly were his motivations in what he did was something that we'll be discussing in one second, and what it means for European asylum policy, we still don't know, because at the moment on the table in the EU is still considering, yes, the crisis was brought under control, and we can debate the merits and demerits of how it was handled in a minute, but we haven't decided the structural changes that this will bring to European asylum legislation, European crisis management legislation. At the moment on the table in the Council, we are revisiting the Schengen Borders Code for the issue of instrumentalisation. We are looking again at the EU's asylum and migration management regulation with a view to what happens in an instrumentalisation crisis, something that we had never thought of before. So while this seemed like, to us Europeans, of course, we can be quite Eurocentric in Europe and everything happens to us, it's happened for the first time. But of course, not only...
Americans are definitely not that way.
But of course, this had happened even in Europe many times before. And as the EU comes to consider its response, now that we have at least some breathing space on this matter, we need to understand this phenomenon in a deep way. And we need to understand its manifestations, what typically is at stake in the game between a country or a party that is trying to use irregular migration flows in this way, and what the defending state can do. Now, I want to very, very clearly put the proviso down right now that when we're discussing this, because Kelly, who I'm going to properly introduce in one second, is a political scientist and international relations theorist. I obviously work in ICMPD. If it seems like we're discussing this matter coldly, it is only to help deepen the understanding so that migrants are never used as negotiating chips in this way again. So please, I want to put that proviso down now, including for the 1,200 people watching from elsewhere, that this is clearly understood and we are not trivializing the matter and we are not forgetting that the awful human scenes that were there last year.
We're not endorsing it.
And certainly we're not endorsing it. Having said that, we'd like to conduct this conversation in good spirits. And without further ado, there's nobody better to help us understand and get a deeper sense of this phenomenon than Professor Kellyanne Greenhill, who has faculty appointments at Tufts University and MIT. I think you did your PhD at MIT as well.
Yes.
And you did your bachelor's in Harvard, as I understand.
I have a piece of paper from Harvard, but I went to college at Berkeley.
I'd like UC a piece Berkeley. Of paper from both of those places, so or all four of those places. Also, what I didn't realize, Kelly, and we've been actually chatting all year about this phenomenon, that you have also been in and out of government at various points and also advising international organizations at various points. And I must say, Kelly, in addition to that, you are, of course, the author of a very famous book called Weapons of Mass Migration, Forced Displacement, Coercion and Foreign Policy, where you have comprehensively documented this phenomenon in 2011. And now you're working on a new version of the book because you were, for many years, a voice crying in the wilderness, trying to convince people that you weren't Genghis Khan. This just happens. And it may not happen in isolation with other things, but it is a phenomenon. And just the first point, I was very struck by a footnote in your book where you said you were speaking at an international conference. Somebody came up to you and said, listen, I mean, your arguments are perfectly well made. I find them very persuasive. I find them very convincing, but I just don't believe that this ever actually happens. And you've had to conquer that skepticism. But I think after Lukashenko's intervention last year, nobody will doubt again. Let's do the jumping off point here, and it's great that we're finally having this conversation because, you know, you're basically turning me into your postdoc student at this point. I'm getting back notes with like handwritten corrections from Kelly where I haven't understood something properly. So in terms of terminology, let's start off with how do we think about the different kinds of instrumentalization, weaponization, whatever you want to call it?
So I will answer that question in just a second. I do want to take this opportunity to also note to fix a common misapprehension about Belarus's use of this tool. Even his employment of travel agents and trying to encourage people from coming from other parts of the world to Minsk to then send them on to the European Union, even that was not new. Lukashenko ripped a page right out of Erich Honecker's, East German Erich Honecker's playbook. This is exactly what he did in the mid-1980s. He used newspaper ads. He placed them in newspapers all over the Middle East and in South Asia, encouraging people to come to East Berlin, promise them safe and comfortable transit and easy and unimpeded transport into West Berlin. And people took Honecker at his word. These folks traveled on Soviet bloc airlines to Berlin. They were transited into West Germany. Asylum applications into West Germany went up by 109% between 1984 and 1985. And Germany had to eventually make a number of concessions to Honecker, financial, technical assistance, and a few others. So just as a little parenthetical note there. Mm-hmm. So in terms of the instrumentalization of migration, there are four variants or four different ways in which this tool can be used. The first is what I call dispossessive engineered migration, and that's effectively where mass migrations are threatened or induced in order to seize the property or the territory of a particular group or to, should say, defang them as a potential threat to the dominance of the group that's inducing the migration. And a recent example would be the Myanmar junta's mass forced migration or even genocide, if you will, of Rohingya, 1.4 million forcibly displaced out of Myanmar into neighboring Bangladesh and elsewhere. A second variant is exportive engineered migration, and that those are threatened or actual out-migrations designed to defang domestic dissidents, discomfit, humiliate, or otherwise even in extremis destabilize potential target states. And I think that's exactly what Lukashenko was up to. He may have had other agendas, but apropos of what we heard from our Lithuanian colleague this morning, regime revenge, that sounds a lot of like export of engineered migration. The third variant is militarized engineered migration, and that's real or threatened movements of mass movements of people undertaken to gain battlefield advantage. And we often see this in the context of armed conflict. Because the dominant form of conflict in the world today is civil wars, we don't see this happening as often on the international stage in the here and now. But one might say, even in the context of the Syrian civil war, ISIS's use of militarized engineered migration in the service or the pursuance of the greater caliphate be an example of militarized engineered migration. And finally, there's coercive engineered migration, which is often conflated or used synonymously with instrumentation. And again, instrumentation is broader, but coercive engineered migration refers to real or threatened out-migrations designed to extract concessions, economic, military, or political, from a target state or states. And
that's interesting that you wanted to start with that proviso about Honecker, because actually, when one big theme I take from your work is the danger of forgetting that this has all happened before.
And before.
Yes, probably since the time of Babylon, there were, the idea of using population movements to discomfort an opponent in some way or to get a political advantage. You know, I think you started your work from 1957 for a very particular reason, or 1951.
51.
Because of the Geneva Convention.
Exactly.
And in that sense, there's a real danger to the U.S. is one example. I think there was a very good example in your book that when the Mariel boat lift, when the Cubans started coming in boats to the States, mm-hmm. officials were baffled that they had to relearn all the lessons because Castro had already used this before, right?
Yes, 15 years before. And in fact, Victor Palmieri, who was the highest ranking U.S. official who had to deal with this problem, came out of the Situation Room 8 days into the crisis. And someone mentioned Camia Roca, which was the first massive Cuban outflow and happened in 1965. And Palmieri went and said, "Wait, you mean this has happened before?" It completely blew his mind. And he was the highest ranking U.S. official tasked with dealing with this situation. Nobody had briefed him. And this has happened also time and time again. And to the extent that we continue to forget the lessons of these past crises, we cripple ourselves in terms of combating them or deterring them.
I think it's a real danger for us in Europe, because although I was on the inside in the European Council for the 2015 crisis, we were sure the EU could, it is such a politically explosive crisis, we were sure that the EU could never unlearn the lessons from that crisis. But, you know, you can unlearn lessons for a lot of reasons. You can be distracted by other things. The EU has been very distracted by other things in the last couple of years, COVID, Ukraine, et cetera, et cetera. So it's possible to forget to remember in this respect.
And it can take a while. I mean, I don't imagine, given the salience of the issue these days, that there's going to be immediate forgetting, but it could happen down the line.
But, I mean, one of the things I found really hard to grasp in the book is that the U.S. actually ousted a leader of a country over this issue.
Well, more than one.
Well, would you care to elaborate?
Are you referring to Aristide?
Yes.
Okay. So the story didn't start with Aristide's, as we'd say, assisted relocation, golden parachute. But rather, when the military, I make this quick, pretty quick, the military junta took over power in Haiti in 1991. And at the time, the Bush administration decided on a policy of summarily treating all Haitians who were fleeing the regime at that time as economic migrants, even though they were fleeing a rather unstable and dangerous situation on the ground in Haiti. When Bill Clinton was running for president against H.W. Bush, he promised to reverse this policy, this racist policy whereby Cubans and Haitians were not being treated equitably or fairly, and said if he were elected, then Haitians would be treated just like all other potential asylum seekers. Well, Clinton was elected in November 1992, and as may come as no surprise to you, Haitians started building boats and rafts preparing for their welcome to the U.S. that was going to happen. Well, incumbent President Clinton panicked and decided this was not exactly what he had in mind when he said he was going to revisit U.S. Haiti policy. And got in touch with exiled President Jean-Bertrand Aristide and said, effectively, can we make a deal? I'll do what I can diplomatically to get you reinstalled into power. Do what you can to make sure that that we don't have a Haitian boat person or potential asylum seeker crisis to coincide with my inauguration day. Clinton says, Clinton and Aristide make a deal. Time passes. Aristide remains out of power. More time passes. Aristide remains out of power. Some pressure starts mounting domestically to see Haitian U.S. policy towards Haitians changed. I'm simplifying this a bit and telling you in a quick and dirty way, but let's jump forward to the summer, spring and summer of 1994, and after a televised hunger strike by Randall Robinson and significant intervention by the Congressional Black Caucus, the Clinton administration does decide to change Haitian policy or policy towards Haitians, and Haitians again start building boats and rafts to prepare for their welcome in the United States. Clinton again contacts Aristide and says, we should do a deal, or I'm going to get you back in. And Aristide says, basically, I call it. That's a technical term, I apologize.
It's a family
conference. Your credibility is shot, I don't believe you. And in fact, not only will I not go on TV and call up my friends and tell them to stay in Haiti like I did last time, but I'm going to go on TV, and he did, and say, I can't tell Haitians to remain in what is effectively a house on fire. 'Tis better to die at sea than to,
that's incredible.
To die here. And they did. So the U.S. then launches or prepares to launch a forced entry operation with only the approval of only about one-third of the American public to see Aristide reinstalled in power. And they don't need to do it because the junta does step down after some last-minute negotiations. Aristide is reinstalled into power in 1994. That's a long preamble, but important.
I wanted you to tell that story.
First, it's important to note that the U.S. was effectively coerced into launching a military operation to effect regime change in order to see someone reinstalled in power. Aristide then, though, tries this gambit once again about 11 years later when his regime is again under threat. And Aristide starts making statements saying, unless I get international peacekeepers on the ground here in Haiti, unless I get some help, I can't promise that there won't be another migration crisis. Well, the French immediately call for Aristide to be removed. The U.S. is a little bit more equivocal for a while. And then overnight, when Aristide appears to be escalating his threats, we the U.S. decide it's his time has come. The U.S. sends a plane to Port-au-Prince, and Aristide is, as I said, relocated for an extended period of time to the Central African Republic, and that was the end of the Aristide regime. Okay. That was a long answer to your question, I'm sorry, but cases embedded in there.
Sure. Yeah. I wanted you to tell that story, just to make it real, how real this can get in terms of to the highest level of government and the most serious decision a government can make, which is to forcibly remove the leader of another country. But it strikes me also that in that case, why can this tactic be used against liberal democracies so effectively? And it's because I think what you call in the book, we have very high hypocrisy costs, that basically by espousing the Geneva Convention and technically being open to protect asylum seekers, this tool can be very well used against us, because it's not just the state that uses the attacking state that's a player. It's also people inside the receiving state who go, oh, no, you should let these people in. This is wrong. As would happen in the Lukashenko case, as would happen with the Cuban. I've often looked at the U.S.-Cuba parallel, mm-hmm. because under U.S. law, every Cuban is a refugee, because the anyone fleeing the regime should receive instant refugee status in the U.S., no?
Policy's changed, and that used to be the case. It is no longer the case.
I see. So I'm interested in this idea of liberal democracies being the chief targets.
So for a long time that was true, and it remains true. Hypocrisy costs are what I call in the book a force multiplier, but they are neither necessary nor sufficient to affect this kind of coercion. So there are actually two ways in whereby course of engineering migration can be affected. And one is what we might loosely just call capacity swamping. And that's through threats or actual overwhelming a state's or target state's ability to assimilate or respond to a potential inflow of displaced people. The second mechanism is what I call political agitation. And political agitation
is blackmail.
They're both blackmail in some sense, but in one set of circumstances, you're essentially saying, I'm just going to overwhelm you with people or overwhelm your ability to deal with this crisis. In the other case is, I'm going to undermine your willingness. So when we're dealing with advanced industrial countries, many of whom are liberal democracies, it's not about can you accommodate these people, it's about whether or not you are willing to accommodate these people. And in most advanced liberal democracies, there is a heterogeneity of opinions about whether or not displaced people should be taken in. And on one side, there are a group of people who either think this particular group, Cubans, Haitians, Ukrainians, should be taken in, and they're joined with people who think no matter who the group is, they should be taken in. These are the pro-migrant refugee group. On the other side, there are quite often groups who are opposed to either anybody, broadly opposed, or they're opposed to particular groups.
Because I bring this up because it's because it's important. In the Lukashenko case, there were, for many people in Europe, they did not see the hand of a dictator from an authoritarian regime behind the people suddenly arriving at the Lithuanian and Polish border. They just saw the need of these people. And you know, I don't say this was right or wrong. These are just the two perspectives on the crisis. I even had friends of mine from home asking me, "Is this right or wrong? What's happening here?" And all I could tell them was, "But there is a deeper manipulation going on." Mm-hmm. And the question for a lot of people is, "Well, what would have happened if they just opened the borders in this case?" You know, what you call in your list of options, which includes regime change, of course. But then there's on the opposite end of the spectrum, there's accommodation.
Yes.
So open the borders, make it so that this is not a weapon at all.
Yes.
Do you think maybe we should have employed this tactic in this particular case?
These are complicated issues, and I think it would be unfair for me to second guess what the Europeans did. I'm not a European. I can say that in any given potential crisis, policymakers have a toolbox. None of the options is a silver bullet. None is likely to solve a problem. Well, it should say, none is guaranteed to make an issue solved in perpetuity, but having options is better than having no options.
Sure. There's two other reflections I'd like to explore, which is, number one, there's also much, much softer versions of instrumentalization. Mm-hmm. For example, I was interested I'm very interested in the parallels between the US and the European, because I think there's a lot to be learned. So the US managed to end the boat crisis with Haiti, with Cuba. Mm-hmm. In Europe, we have not. We have had a boat crisis for over 10 years and are still largely unable to decisively address it. But then that pressure, as we see today, in the last year in the US, there's been a huge crisis on the US land border. Mm-hmm. And that is almost linked to the ending of the boat crisis in a way, because it's as a result of a more passive, I don't know, would you describe it as instrumentalization, but it's the visa policy of Nicaragua, no?
I would say that's a contributing factor. There may be other people in the audience who want to weigh in on this, but let's say it's not helping the matter. But I wouldn't say it's the sole cause of the explosion in arrivals on the southern border. But
something like 2 million people, I understand.
2 million people in the last year.
That's much higher than you.
And yes. So it is a contributing factor, no doubt. I'm not sure how many people in the audience know that Nicaragua, similar to the Western Balkans brouhaha, that Nicaragua offered visa-free travel to all Cubans starting last November. Available evidence, which is arguably scant, does suggest that both Cuba and Nicaragua are benefiting economically from this little arrangement, but also it's, I think, unequivocally the case that both Cuba and Nicaragua can see this as a potentially effective political tool against the U.S. in the way that it has been in the past. If nothing else, then as a sort of Damocles to hold over the U.S.'s head in the context of there's 200,000 Cubans came in the last year, how many might come in the future? And it's worth noting that 200,000 is a significantly larger number than the 125,000 who came during the Mario boatlift. And Jimmy Carter, although I'm not sure, I don't think he's right about this, but Carter is convinced he lost the 1980 election because of the Mario boatlift. There was the Iran hostage crisis and the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, and the economy wasn't in great shape. There were other things going on, but Carter is convinced. And also, the cast of characters that we've heard from before, Bill Clinton is convinced he lost his gubernatorial reelection because of the Cubans who were stationed in a military bases inside Arkansas that year, and there were some non-trivial problems associated with them being hosted there. So the two American political leaders convinced that they lost important elections in 1980 due to Mariel.
Mm-hmm. We're moving towards a sort of maybe taking some questions from the audience, but before we did that, I also wanted to point out that in many cases, the attacker, be they a state or be they a non-state, because we have also said it's non-states, be they Nicaragua, be they Cuba, be they Colonel Gaddafi in Libya, they can. It's a dangerous tactic to use.
Yes.
Your research shows that it's very often the tool of the weak or the weaker party in order to draw attention to other political issues that they feel is being ignored. But they can also lose control of the issue.
Yes.
They can lose control. They can trigger migratory flows, but then they can then become the victim of them themselves. Is this
so? In the cases I identified for the first edition of the book, in about 80% of the cases, the challenger was, in capability sense, weaker than the targets. In about 20%, the coercer was more powerful, and in the remaining 10%, they had about equal power. It is rarely a tool of first resort. Quite often, this is a tool that's used by actors who feel like they need to get the attention of advanced liberal democracies or wealthy countries who are not willing to talk to them or who feel hard done by. And so this tool can be a method of leveling the playing field and opening up discussion space that wasn't previously open. Mm-hmm. I'm not advocating it, but that it is viewed as a tool that is seen as necessary by some actors.
Well, it has happened.
Yes.
So we know it. I'd like to open up to maybe a round of questions, maybe two, three questions. Roman and our colleague will collect some if there are any. We have one over here at the back.
Well, thank you, David Kipp. My name from SWP in Berlin. Very fascinating talk. I was just wondering, in the list of options, if you could still talk a bit about that and maybe also about the case of the EU-Turkey agreement and how that option is something that has been used before and maybe also will be used in other cases. How do you see that particular example within this framework?
Question from, yes. I think the US has been mentioned enough that Martha deserves to take the floor.
No statement, just a question. Actually, two. So in the previous panel, what was mentioned, they mentioned about various states in the United States busing or flying people.
Darn it, I was hoping you were going to answer the question. I was going to evade it.
Yeah.
All right.
Do you consider that instrumentalization? Okay. And then my second question is a nomenclature question. Your book, Weapons of Mass Migration, right? Folks have had problems with using the word weaponization because it does play into the idea that migrants are dangerous and thus weapons. And so there's been talk about saying just use the word instrumentalization or use the word exploitation, which I'm not in favor of because migrants are exploited in so many ways that it doesn't. But I'm curious if you have now, years after the publishing of your book, if you have a different preference for a verb.
Tobias, but also at the back, wants to...
Thank you very much, Tobias Molander from the Austrian Ministry of the Interior, very much for this most fascinating panel. I think this important topic is so timely because it puts the spotlight on two of the most pressing issues that we face at the moment. The one thing is the lack of an efficient and effective asylum immigration policy in the European Union. And the second thing is the lack of an efficient and strong foreign policy of the European Union. Although, as Hugo mentioned, we were quite successful in the case of the Belarusian crisis. I'm not yet completely sure if we reacted quickly and well in all the cases. My question would be instrumentalization, I think, is threefold, a political, legal, and moral dilemma, because in the cases of Belarus and other cases, there was a strong political agreement in Europe that what we were doing was just and right to protect our external borders, that we must not be blackmailed. But on the other hand, as Hugo said, with the Geneva Convention, we have strong legal obligations in the field of asylum, in the field of non-refoulement. How can you really reconcile those two ideals, strong, effective borders, without violating the principle of non-refoulement in that regard? And I also want to refer, for example, to Gerald Knaus, the migration expert, who brought up the idea of agreements with safe third countries, that people who are in protection needs should be able to apply for asylum but not remain within the European Union. Maybe you can react on that as well. Thank you very much.
Okay, I think that's enough for the limited time we have left. So, Kelly, if you want to take most of those things, and I could talk about the EU-Turkey side, if you liked, or if you can take them all, either, it doesn't matter.
So I have to apologize to the last questioner. There was something about the acoustics here. If I have mangled your question and I don't answer it, please ask it again, whether that's during the panel or after the fact. But what my takeaway was, how do you reconcile the principle of non-refoulement and the clear and quite understandable desire of states to protect their borders? And I would say it's really hard. And that's, in fact, why this tool works, because leaders are caught between a rock and a hard place. And if, in all cases, one could simply decide we're going to take all of these people, or we didn't care about human rights protections, I think we should, and we're just going to close our border, then leaders wouldn't be in a conundrum. But it's not possible to simultaneously take in a group and keep them out. And thus, the incentives to concede in whole or in part to the demands of some of these coercers can become quite acute, which is why what I found in the looking at the data for the book, the cases I identified by 2011, that in about three quarters of cases, targets conceded in part to coercers' demands. In about 57% of cases, they conceded to all of the articulated demands of challengers, coercers. And you might say 57%, that's not that high. It seems like maybe a coin flip. But the U.S.'s own track record on coercive diplomacy, we're the most powerful country in the international system. When we throw our military might around and try to get others to do our bidding, best case scenario, we're successful, or best estimate, we're successful about 40% of the time. So even 57% is pretty efficacious. That being said, for reasons Hugo already mentioned, this is not a tool of first resort, and so it may be the case that it's actually still a pretty lousy method of persuasion, but it's only used by actors who are pretty darn sure that their targets are going to be vulnerable. So if you carefully choose your targets, then your success rate is going to appear, if you will, artificially high. So there are many actors who might be self-deterred. So if that answered your question, then great. If it didn't, please ask it again later. In answer to Marta's questions, I would say yes, this is a kind of what's going on domestically is a kind of instrumentalization. The focus of my work, most of my work heretofore, hasn't been within the domestic context, but speaking to the aforementioned Cuban and Haitian cases, this isn't actually the first time we've seen political circuses or three-ring circuses whereby people are involuntarily moved within our country, or we see activities undertaken by governors that upend or call into question the viability of federal responses. So even this is not new. This particular flavor, I'm not aware of something that looks exactly like what's going on now, but it certainly rhymes very tightly with some of the things we've seen before. In terms of what I rename the book, No.
I think you're just a very good writer. you're an unusual academic in that you are a very good writer. I mean, that is rare. And I personally bless you for that. You know, that's your work is readable.
Well, but thank you. That's very kind of you. But maybe I had a good editor too. Thank you. People didn't start using the true victims of this tool, the displaced themselves. They didn't start using people as weapons when I wrote this book. It's been going on for a very, very, very long time. They didn't stop using it when I wrote this book. My title is epiphenomenal, as we would say in social science. So I quite understand people's frustration about that people are being weaponized. I share this frustration, and in fact, that's why I wrote the book, because I think if we don't talk about the fact that this is happening, we can't combat it. And so if more people read this book because of this provocative title, I wouldn't say it's inflammatory, but if more people read this book and we can think about how to combat this tool and better protect those that are deserving of protection, I call that a win. And so if I sound offensive, I don't mean to sound offensive, but that's my answer. And to the question about the options. The options are four. The first is concession. And as I've already suggested, more often than not, we see concession. Will that change now that the Europeans have a more well-developed toolbox, now that the U.S. is not going to forget anytime soon what's going on? Maybe. Since the second edition of the book is going to be coming out next year, I can make all sorts of new predictions.
Jump in because we're running out of time.
Okay. Second option is making the game not worth playing. So, and that can happen either through essentially saying, do your worst, send them all to us, we'll take them. Or it can be through abrogating one's human rights responsibilities. I don't recommend this. I don't advocate it, but it's an option.
But you also have another another version of this, which I find super... it's to answer this gentleman's question. So in the book, you say, confident of their superior strength and position, powerful targets fail to realize until late in the game that they might lose. The added tragedy is that not only does this lead to more migrant victims, but it also leads to suboptimal outcomes for both sides. And then you go through your three options, because I wanted to get into Tobias's question on vulnerability.
Yes.
You say, you know what? You're better off negotiating early, and because you will come to an agreement at a lower price.
Potentially, than
the teeth of a crisis. Now, many of our member states and officials here will not like that message, because they say we are not going to advertise ourselves for blackmail by doing deals early, letting people know that this is an issue at which they can extract things from us.
Negotiation is not a deal, number one. But also, historically, I mean, one of the reasons that this tool was hiding in plain sight is that for a very, very long time, both challengers and targets didn't advertise it. Like, much of the important diplomacy that goes on in the world, this was happening on the QT. So what I would say to potential target states is when you start hearing noises where disgruntled actors say, you may give me no choice but to resort to something like this, you should take them seriously. That doesn't mean sit down and give them everything they want, but it's pay attention, because you're going to have to probably sit down with them anyway if they start a migration flow that you're going to have to deal with. So recognize you can do it quietly, you can use the good offices of other parties, there are all sorts of ways that this diplomacy can happen quietly, but... And concession is not the same thing as negotiation, but that...
Well, I'm not going to describe the EU-Turkey statement as a result of instrumentalization, but I will say it definitely was the result of a failure to engage earlier on a clearly pressing need for cooperation between the world's biggest refugee hosting state and the European Union. So,
agreed.
But to go back to what Tobias was saying, because I want him to be fully answered, because I know he will criticize me because he wasn't. He mentioned this idea of transfer agreements, we're talking about tactics here, not what's right and wrong. Mm-hmm. So states may say, okay, we'll take people in, but we're going to send genuine asylum seekers to another country, somewhere far away, etc., so that we're not encouraging a pull factor. And indeed, this is one of the options that you have under number two, which is make the game not worth playing. Oddly, the most liberal one of the solutions is there, and the most, for many people here, would be the most extreme, are under the same category, which is make the game not worth playing. Mm-hmm. That is one, let everybody in and say we're not afraid. But two, a kind of reverse instrumentalization where, let's say, a country like Rwanda, which has done agreements with the Denmark and the UK, says, well, we're happy to play with you, as it were, if this means so much to you. Would you agree with this?
This goes back to where I started, where I said, you know, there's options in the toolbox, but we can't necessarily anticipate that it's going to solve the problem forever, because sometimes when we play ball and make these agreements, we then encourage some of these actors who agree to take in people who are displaced to themselves become weaponizers, instrumentalizers. So the island of Nauru, our Australian colleague, may note that, you know, Nauru has taken in any number of people to prevent them from ending up in Australia, but in turn has episodically requested significant financial payments from Australia. And that is not the only example of this happening. So dates can solve a problem in the short term, make it become less visible, but they also can set themselves up for secondary instrumentalization down the line.
You've made that point that in trying to make yourself less vulnerable, you can actually increase vulnerability down the line.
Yes, and sometimes the actors who agree to serve in this role have their own agendas as well, and you know, can't expect they're simply going to do it for free, and so they may get some economic payoffs, they may get some diplomatic payoffs, they may get some future diplomatic payoffs in that their partners may be self-deterred from criticizing them on their human rights records, on any number of other issues, with the expectation that we want to keep the situation on a low simmer and keep everybody happy. So I'm not saying this in a normative way, this is simply a description of the situation.
You've also, maybe a closing or coming to a closing reflection, you've also warned, despite the fact that this is your, let's say, you've written books on other matters, I know it perfectly well, but you've also warned against seeing everything under the lens of weaponization. I think you called it the weaponization of the weaponization of migration.
Yes.
And this is a real fear.
Yes. I live in this peculiar universe where when I started working on this project, I had to convince people that it was actually a real thing. Now it's been, so far as I can tell, overdiagnosed. And it is certainly not the case that every time there's an outflow that it's an example of the weaponization of migration. And so now that we have a hammer, I fear we're starting to see too many nails. And so we should be careful. And so we should recognize that this happens, and we should do what we can to combat it and try to prevent its use, or not put actors in a position where they feel that they need to resort to it. At the same time, every time we see an outflow or a threatened outflow or an expected outflow, threatened outflows are pretty clear. When we see an expected outflow, we see an outflow. It's not always a case of instrumentalization. We should be careful.
Well, Kelly, all I can say in closing is that it's been an absolute privilege and a pleasure to get to know you and your work over the last year. I have a feeling that you will be a frequently invited back guest to Europe by various parties. And I'd now like to close the session and invite our Director General to the floor, Winnie, to make an announcement for the reception.
And I just also want to thank you for the invitation and for all of you for coming. Can I say one last thing?
Sure.
I would like to imagine in some cases that this is the start of the conversation and not the end. So please view my email address as an open door. Be discriminating sending the
email. Be careful.
But please feel free to raise additional questions. I may not answer immediately, but I will get back to you. kmg2@mit.edu. Let's continue the conversation. Thanks to all of you, and thank you for the invitation.
Thanks, Kelly.
Okay, fantastic. Good.
That was a presentation from the Vienna Migration Conference. Author Kelly Greenhill, who wrote the 2010 book titled Weapons of Mass Migration, Forced Displacement, Coercion, and Foreign Policy, was in conversation with an International Center for Migration Policy Development representative. This presentation is from 2022. Greenhill is professor of political science and international relations at Tufts University. Many listeners understand that flooding any country with people from different cultures without proper vetting and processing will lead to a range of severe crises. The concern is so great amid voters in the United States. It was the centerpiece of the Trump election campaign. Why is that? In the last year, listeners have pointed out concerns of the Cloward and Piven strategy, a strategy aiming to utilize militant anti-poverty groups to facilitate a political crisis by overloading the welfare system through the increase in welfare claims, forcing the creation of a system of guaranteed minimum income. Another concern is the Kalergi plan, a white genocide plan designed to mix and replace white Europeans with other races using immigration. This plan is labeled conspiratorial and anti-Semitic. Another one is population infusion from mass migration affecting voter demographics that may benefit a particular political party. I'm sure you've heard all of these before. Depending on the country being attacked, a significant population inflow through migration diplomacy will make that nation vulnerable, no matter what, and it will experience a range of upheavals and change that could include a race replacement, demographic change, and social welfare overload. I thought it was interesting that Professor Greenhill pointed out how migration diplomacy can be used against liberal democracies so effectively, something she termed high hypocrisy costs, that by espousing the Geneva Convention and being open to protect asylum seekers, the country's tolerance is used against its population. Greenhill emphasized the people within the country saying, oh no, you should let these people in, etc., are actually the ones that give the attacking nation the confidence that their tactics of using populations of people to overwhelm the targeted country will be very effective. And very often, the populations of people don't come from the attacking country. The people are migrating from various countries that are working together. We heard Greenhill then answer a question from an audience member about the potential negative nomenclature of her book title, Weapons of Mass Migration, and that title's connotation that migrants are dangerous. Greenhill responded by saying she understands people's frustration about people being weaponized and shares this frustration. And in fact, it's why she wrote the book, saying, quote, I think if we don't talk about the fact that this is happening, meaning that countries are leveraging this attack strategy on other countries, we can't combat it. We can't stop it as an individual sovereign nation because we don't fully understand it. And so if more people read the book, she says, because of this provocative title, I wouldn't say it's inflammatory. Greenhill wrote the book 15 years ago, and this presentation was in 2022, and this dialogue has failed to take hold so far. That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Visit inothernewsradio.com for archives and more information about the guests.
Love and romance. Let's face the music and dance. Before the fiddlers have fled, before they ask us to pay the bill, and while we still have the chance, let's face the music and dance. Soon we'll be without the moon, humming a different tune, and then there may be teardrops to shed. So while there's moonlight and music and love and romance, let's face the music and dance, dance.